And I had a really good run. So my kidney lasted for 5 years, and that's it. A couple of months ago, I actually had to start dialysis again. We did everything right. There was nothing that I could have done to prevent this. It took me a while to tell my cousin because, you know, she saved my life. And because of her, I got to do these incredible things. Like, I got to produce 8 documentaries. I traveled across the country. I did things that there was no way I had any business doing. And so I really feel like I changed. I used it, my opportunity for good.
Have you ever really thought about your kidneys? What they do? How they keep you alive? They are 2 small organs, each about the size of a fist, quietly filtering waste from your blood, balancing fluids, and keeping you alive. Until they don't. There is no cure for kidney disease. Trust me, I know. Dialysis helps you wait, but it isn't a solution. A transplant gives you a second chance, but not forever. So what happens when that second chance runs out? When the kidney that saved your life fails? Welcome to Voices of Leadership, my podcast that tells the stories of women who are redefining success and thriving on the edge of change. Some stories are told from the outside looking in, but not this one. Today, it's personal. In December of 2000, my sister gave me a kidney, a gift of life. But a transplant isn't a cure. It's a reprieve, a chance, a borrowed moment. And sometimes that moment runs out. My guest today, Christina Howrun, knows that better than most. She's an award-winning television journalist and a documentary producer. Someone who has spent her career exposing injustices and shining a light on stories that need to be told. She's also a fellow kidney transplant recipient. And now, she is facing the unthinkable. Her kidney has failed. And she's waiting once again for another chance at life. And today, we're telling her story. Our conversation today is deeply personal. It sheds a light on the realities of kidney disease, what transplantation truly is, because it's not a cure, and the challenges and gifts that come with being a transplant recipient. March is Kidney Month, and this episode is part of Podcastathon, a global initiative uniting podcasters to support charities worldwide. If you enjoyed this conversation, if you learned something from this conversation, I encourage you to take action. You'll find links in the show notes where you can support the Kidney Foundation and register as an organ donor. Because stories like Christina's are still being written, and you might just be the person who helps write the next chapter. Thanks so much for agreeing to do this. I really appreciate it.
No, I'm excited for it. And full disclosure, I do have a dog on my lap.
Yay! So. I have a cat that shows up at some point, so all good. You know, that's how podcasting works. We get all kinds of visitors.
Yes, there's no way she wouldn't be in this room if she could hear my voice.
So. Oh, yeah. I love it. That's so cool. But I really appreciate you doing this. This probably for me is one of the more personal and very important episodes I've ever recorded. So I really appreciate you taking the time and the willingness to share your story.
Well, and you sharing yours, right? That's important.
It is. And for me, it's I'm not shy about it, but I also don't. I have not had the opportunity or maybe the drive to share it as much as you have. So it's good for me to talk about it as well. I agree. And I mean, March is kidney month. So that's what we're talking about. And I mean, as you know, kidney disease varies from person to person. Mine is unknown a little bit more. Yours, I understand, is a bit more hereditary. So why don't we start there? Tell us a little bit about kidney disease in your life and how and when you were diagnosed.
So I'll start it off with this, that both my uncle and my father had kidney transplants, and they were both on dialysis. And because they, back then in the 80s, knew that this type of kidney disease, Alport syndrome, was genetic. So I was going to sick kids every year from the time I was born. And they always thought that I had the gene, but it was the carrier gene and I wouldn't get it. And, you know, the science is always evolving. And they were wrong. So, you know, it was one of those things that I grew up in a very kidney friendly household. Like I still don't have an appetite for, you know, creamy foods and things like that, because they just weren't introduced in my household because of kidney disease. So I went about my life thinking that I was fine, you know, getting regular checkups like any healthy person would. Right? And it was in my early 30s that, you know, I started to feel really bad. I just was so exhausted. And I had just come back from a trip to Thailand, and I kept on thinking, you know, I'm just so tired because this is like a month long jet lag. You know, I'm so cold all the time because it's freezing and live in Canada. My skin is so dry and I'm scratching so much because it's winter time. Like, I could really excuse a lot of these things. And then I did a blood pressure check and I was in the stroke zone. So I said, okay, something must be up. And I went to the doctors, we did blood work, and she's like, here's some blood pressure pills. Like, you know, your job is stressful. We'll figure it out. And I was out on a story, and we're covering a story, and I get a couple of calls from my doctor's office while I'm at a press conference. And so I'm listening to the voicemail, and the voicemail's like, we got your blood results back. You're in kidney failure. You have to go to emergency right now. And I was like, hold on. Like, I'm at work. This is not a real thing. Like, this must be a mistake. So I tried to write it off, but my cameraman was like, okay, here's the deal. Like, I heard that message. You're going to emergency. Which hospital would you like me to take you to? Cause you are not finishing this story today. I was like, fine, I guess I'll go. So I went, and they ran my test again, and yeah, I actually had 8% kidney function.
Ugh.
And they were just, my whole world just went crashing down. You know, I'm sitting there, and I'm at this point, my partner's not with me. Nobody's with me. Cause I'm thinking that they're going to run these tests and I'm going to be going home, and this is what a waste of a day. Right. And, it was soul crushing because it wasn't something so brand new to me, but I knew, you know, from 20 years earlier, I remembered my dad's struggle. He was on dialysis for 4 years. He tried really hard to stay working. He had, let's say, an office kind of job. So he did work from home back when they got him a fax machine to work from home, you know. But I remember that he'd go to dialysis and he spent a lot of days in his bedroom, like sick, lights off, sleeping, no energy. And just like, he took everything he had to take my brother, sister, and I to our sports and activities and to try to keep working. But I just remembered, this can't be real. And it was real. And that's, you know, they admitted me to hospital. I had a really great nephrologist. He kept me off of dialysis for a few months. My mom immediately started the process to try to be a living donor. She was ruled out. I started doing dialysis every single night at home. Peritoneal dialysis, which is like a tube in your stomach. And it just kind of, it fills you up with liquid all night and then it kind of drains it out. I took like a kind of leave of absence because I was on that machine for 10 to 12 hours every single day. I could not do a job that requires you to be out of bed.
Or active, since your job is active. Yes.
Yeah. So I worked 3 days a week, and I was really, really lucky because my cousin Christine, you know, a mom of five, or just a wonderful, beautiful soul, was like, I've got the same blood type. I'm going to go through. And she went through all the testing. And on the very same day, I was only on dialysis for 9 months. But on June 13th of 2019, which is also the day that the Raptors won the NBA championship, I got a kidney transplant from my cousin Christine. And I actually woke up. I was in downtown Toronto at a hospital, University Health Network, Toronto General. And it's on University Avenue. And I woke up and there was just, there were so many people cheering. And I looked up and
the parade.
I was like, why, like, am I in heaven? Did this work? You know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning or so. And it was just people tearing up downtown, just cheering. So it was, I like to say they were cheering for Christine.
Cheering for you.
And I had a really good run. So my kidney lasted for 5 years, and that's it. I got COVID. I didn't have any serious complications. But all of a sudden my numbers started dropping, my functionality, and my fantastic transplant team kept on getting me in for biopsies and tests after tests. And, you know, three different hospitals have looked into this, and it's not because I was looking for second opinions. I just happened to have medical experts at different hospitals, and they all came up with the same conclusion that it looks like when I contracted COVID, it lived in my new kidney and it just slowly ate away at it. So, a couple of months ago, I actually had to start dialysis again.
I'm so sorry that you lost your kidney, because that's, you always think about it. I do. It's a daily fear, and to have it a reality is unfortunate.
And I think, you know, you've been in this situation yourself, right? Where you take your pills every day, you make sure, you know, you deal with all of the side effects of the anti-rejection pills, and having a severely immunocompromised body. And we did everything right. We did everything right. There was nothing that I could have done to prevent this. It took me a while to tell my cousin because, you know, she saved my life. And because of her, I got to do these incredible things. Like, you know, I traveled to Europe and I did trips, you know, socially, we'll say, and with family and friends. But, you know, I got to produce 8 documentaries. I traveled across the country. I did things that there was no way I had any business doing. And so I really feel like I changed. I used it, my opportunity for good.
Dialysis. Do you know what it's like? I don't. But I can assure you, it's not what it looks like on TV. It's scary. We've heard Christina's story, the diagnosis, the transplant, the hope, and then the unthinkable, losing her kidney. Now she's back where no transplant recipient ever wants to be, on dialysis. Christina shows us her wall of dialysis, shelves lined with supplies, boxes stacked high, the tools she needs to keep herself alive while she waits. And here's what makes Christina remarkable. While she's navigating all of this, the exhaustion, the risks, the fear of something as simple yet catastrophic as a power outage, she's still doing what she does best, telling stories, shining a light on others, reporting, investigating, and pushing forward. So what does life look like when every day revolves around staying alive? And how do you keep going when survival depends on a machine? That's what we talk about next.
You know, like I'll show you this. This is my dialysis wall.
Wow.
And that's about a month's worth of supplies.
And you're doing it at home, right?
I do it at home. This time I'm doing hemodialysis, which is, we're doing it four to five times a week. Mm-hmm. I don't do it while I'm sleeping, so it takes up a lot of time. And, you know, and it's scary. It, you know what? I'll be honest, Amy, it's really scary because I've had episodes where I've crashed while I'm on the machine, and that means that I've passed out. I've had seizures while on the machine, and I've never had a seizure before in my life. You know, I have to plan out that I can't eat for like 3 hours before. Then I'm on the machine for 4 hours because my blood pressure will drop. It's, you know, today was the order day, order all my new supplies. So I feel like I'm kind of doing inventory, and like it's a lot to juggle. But, you know, I have no other option. It's this or death.
Right. And I think being reliant on so many outside sources is part of the scary part, I would imagine.
It really is. You know, I'm reliant on my dialysis supplier to actually deliver the right supplies. I have to rely on the fact that I'm going to have electricity, and that, you know, in a storm like today's, we're not going to have, or winter weather that we just regularly have, that I'm not going to lose power while I'm hooked up to the machine. I'm dependent on when I do travel for work. And I do stay within Canada, that a hospital in that city can accommodate me so that I can continue to do my job. Because I think that's important. If I'm not doing something, I feel like we're very blessed that we live in Canada, because with lots of planning and generous hospitals across Canada, and if you only go to big cities, yes. And, you know, it was still very possible for me to continue doing a documentary last year in Alberta. And spending a lot of time in Calgary, I've been working on another project in Vancouver. It just requires a lot of times a lot of notice and a lot of pre-planning. But I've been lucky. But yeah, it's something that's hidden, because people, I think that when people find out that I'm sick again, they expect me to be really gaunt.
They expect you to look different. It's not a very outwardly physical disease for the most part, until I found anyway. Until after I had the transplant, and then people realized how terrible I looked. I was gray. I was not well. I was tired all the time, as you referenced. But it's not openly, you can't just pick somebody out of a line and say, oh, they are on dialysis, or they have kidney disease, or they're waiting for a transplant, or anything, any of those things.
No, you can't. And I think that, you know, you and I have talked about this in the past, but the day that I got my the day that I felt good after my transplant, right, when I woke up in my own bed and I realized, oh my gosh, this is how people live.
Yes.
Right? It was like,
because you forget.
Yeah. It just becomes your new normal.
Well, and it's very slow progressing. I mean, it sounds like you had a very similar experience where you're working and you're going hard and you can come up with all the reasons why you are tired or, you know, you can't function properly. Or, I mean, for me, I was a little bit younger. I was 25. I had finished university. I had finished my master's degree and I had started working and I was exhausted and I felt like I was this person that couldn't handle a real job. You know, you came up with any excuse possible before the doctor tells you your blood pressure is in stroke level and you have this whole other reality crash down on you.
I almost wish that there was something that was so outwardly visible just so people could see, right?
Yes.
There are days where I don't have the energy to do things. And I try as much as I can. It's like sometimes I wake up in the morning and within a half hour, I need to lie down. And that's really difficult when you're trying to still be a productive member of society. You're still trying, you know, I'm very passionate about my field. I love looking into, you know, acts of malfeasance and trying to see if I can right an injustice or shine a light on some good that somebody's doing. And it kills me when it's like, I just don't have the energy to do things.
It's hard and you want to keep your job and you want to not keep your job. You want to keep working because your mental health is probably quite dependent on it. I know mine was. And, you know, before we go further, why don't we talk a little bit about that? You are a journalist and, you know, you're a curious and passionate person. Did you always want to become a journalist?
I actually did.
I love that.
Yeah. So it took me a long while to get here, but from a very young age, I wanted to be a journalist. And my father just didn't think it was a very good career choice. You know, he wanted me to be a lawyer.
Yeah. Oh, my parents did too. I think everybody does.
Right. So I did my undergrad in poli-sci. And I got into law school and I had a big conversation with my father where I said, like, you know what? I'm just not ready for this yet. I want to go do grad school and I'm going to go to grad school instead and all of that. And he was like, okay, you know, go to grad school, but you'll go to law school afterwards, right? I went to grad school. I got the job that I was supposed to get, like in government and senior level bureaucrat and all of that kind of stuff. But my job took a long time to kick in and it was one of those things where it was like, I had a lot of time. And so I just said, you know, just for fun, I'm going to freelance. Cause you know, I'm just going to see if I can be a writer. And by the time my job started, I just hated it. And I was like, no, I went back to school. So I quit a very good job that took a year to get.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah, an executive level government job, just straight out of grad school to say, no, I want to go be a traffic reporter. So, but I'm so happy that I did because I went back to school while working full time as a traffic reporter and freelancing and writing articles about technology, things I had no business writing about. I was Googling every single thing that I was writing about. But yeah, I'm really, really happy because I feel like I've been very blessed to have a career where I feel like I am making a difference and I get to learn something new every day.
Yeah. You tell great stories and like, who wouldn't want to do that? It sounds like such a varied job. I don't think I would guess there's no day that are the same.
No. And it's really great like that. Sometimes because of kidney disease, I wish it was a little bit more monotonous, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. data entry might be a little bit easier to do my dialysis machine versus like in-depth research and trying to have phone calls when your machine's beeping and, you know, you're trying to deal with things. But yeah, I'm really, really lucky. And as are you, because now you're doing this and isn't it fun?
I am. It is fun. I get to meet all these different people and I get to tell all these amazing stories. So I feel very fortunate to do that as well. Do you know the power of checking a box and having a conversation? How one simple decision to say yes to organ donation, can mean the difference between life and death for someone else? Have you done it? Have you told your family? Have you signed your organ donor card? If not, why? Here's what's at stake. One organ donor can save up to 8 lives. Right now, in Ontario alone, about 1,400 people are waiting for a life-saving transplant. And every 3 days, someone dies still waiting. Last year, just over 1,000 organs were transplanted from deceased donors. That's 1,000 second chances and 1,000 families who didn't have to say goodbye too soon. But for many, the call never comes. Christina knows this better than most, and she's not just waiting, she's advocating. Through her work with the Kidney Foundation and organ donation organizations, she's making sure more people understand what's at stake. Because becoming an organ donor isn't just a medical decision, it's a human one, and it starts with you. I want to go back to a couple of things because you talked about so many things on your, from the moment you were diagnosed with kidney disease to needing the transplant to going through which family member was your living donor to living with a transplant and now on dialysis. You talked a lot about how people can't see it. So when we're sick, let's talk a little bit about how people can't see it post-transplant. So you and I know this, but it's not common knowledge. A transplant isn't a cure, it's a treatment. And I don't think many people fully understand what life is like after a kidney transplant. So let's talk a little bit about what do you think the biggest myth or misunderstanding people have about life post-transplant?
You know, I really struggled with the weight gain because of the steroids that they put you on. I actually had a viewer write into me saying, you know, I'm worried about your health and maybe you're not eating right. Oh. And yeah, you end up gaining a lot of weight. Like, at least for me, it was my face and just everywhere, and none of my clothes fit. And it wasn't because I was all of a sudden eating whatever I wanted. It was literally because I was on steroids, and I still am on steroids. It's just a much reduced dose, especially at the beginning. You know, that to me was a big thing because I think people expected that I would just bounce back. And while I felt great, there was outwardly, I probably even looked sicker. Because I did bloat out.
Yeah, people don't expect you to look like that after. I think for me, some of the medications, the tremors were quite bad right after. And then also you mentioned and you talked about how it's likely you lost your kidney because of COVID. But I'm assuming that in conjunction with that was the lack of an immune system. And I think that's what I struggle with most is people forget that as much as I may look like you and we can do the same things, I don't have an immune system and there are risks that are not risks for you.
It's so true. I really struggled during COVID when I would, because I do want to hear people out, but you know, if you weren't going to be vaccinated, then you couldn't come near me. You couldn't come in our house.
Yeah. And I was the bad guy.
And it was really difficult because people are like, you're not old. No, but I have no immune system. There's a reason why transplant patients were top priority with 90-year-olds to get vaccines because we don't have anything to fight it. We had to choose. And I was getting messages. I don't know about you, but I was getting messages from the hospital saying, please make sure.
But highlighted. They're never highlighted. They were highlighted.
Yeah. Make sure you take your medicine. Please do not take your anti or your immunosuppressant. Stop, like, just take everything. Do not lose your organ to try and combat this. Because I'm sure people were trying to pick, like, what were you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you talk about with the 90 being prioritized with the 90-year-olds, even before COVID, the flu shot, way back when, before Shoppers Drug Mart even had them, me and my immediate family, my husband and my children, we all take it. But I was prioritized at the doctor's office with the 90-year-olds, most of them, you know, with oxygen tanks and immunosuppressant other things, and then me. And that is something I think people don't see on a regular basis, and they don't appreciate it, and they forget. And I find it extremely frustrating.
It is. You know, we've had, I'm sure we had hand sanitizer before, but certainly after the transplant, those hand sanitizer are right at the front door.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you walk in, just so you don't ruin any, you know, you don't touch outside stuff right away. And I don't think that people can really appreciate that.
No.
That was how we were living. You know, the first days of COVID, I don't know about you, Amy, but I was
scary.
I was a shut-in.
I didn't go to the grocery store for 8 months. My husband went, and before we understood everything, so in March and April, I guess I would say,
yeah,
he was washing the fruit and, you know, taking the bags off in the garage. And he was my husband, Stephen, is fantastic about protecting me. But the stress on him to protect something that he didn't know anything about or understand the parameters of was a toll. And yeah, I was a shut-in, absolutely a shut-in. I didn't go anywhere.
Yeah. There was little, even just, I need dog food. I can't go get the dog food. Please go pick up my prescription. I need shampoo. let me see what old shampoos I didn't want to use anymore because I couldn't go anywhere. We were the level of concern was so great.
Yeah. And even to go back further, I have reflux, which is, I call it peeing backwards, but it's, similar to heartburn, but with the kidneys. And so for a while there, my old kidneys were still active and they would get infected quite frequently because they're useless and that's what they would do. And I would get sick and my new kidney was fine. But I would be out for a bit. And one was during Christmas and I was like, oh, I'll try and order. It was before you could really shop online. I was like, if I could order everything online from my couch, I would be in heaven. And so I'm happy about that now, but it was way back before you could. I think I could only order from like Indigo or something like that.
Right. Right. It's different. Right. And, going out for a couple glasses of wine, something I was doing after my transplant, because as long as you're drinking in moderation and all of that kind of stuff. But now it's like, I'm on liquid restrictions. I'm only supposed to be drinking about a liter a day. So a glass of wine is like, well, I guess that's my coffee, right? Like
it's right. It's a choice. These choices that you make. Yeah.
I have to choose. Same, and in the wintertime, it's really difficult because I really depend on coffees and teas to keep me warm, right? And soups.
I drink like 4 or 5 cups of tea a day. I wouldn't do well. I was fortunate not to be on dialysis. So I learn a lot from the things that you're talking about and reduce liquid. That would be difficult. I mean, I was on an extremely reduced diet to preserve my old kidney prior to transplant. Right. So I did go through some of that for a short period of time. It's not easy.
It isn't, because it's not like people are saying, oh, don't eat fast food. Fine. Yeah, obviously don't eat fast food. But also it's, don't eat cheese.
Protein, potassium, nuts. All of it.
You think you're being good by having like flaxseed bread? No, absolutely not. No. Please go get white Wonder Bread.
I ate white bagels and cream cheese for a very long time. Those were the only things that I could really fit into how I was feeling and what I was allowed to have.
Yeah. It becomes like, literally, I think of a bagel as fast food now, right? Because it is. It's like the fastest thing I can make. And,
because when you're tired, you don't want to cook all the things. I tried the one. I was all after the transplant, even I was, because you're supposed to still keep everything in line and have this diet and all these things. And I tried. I'm not a very good cook. I tried desperately to make homemade pasta sauce because it's supposed to be good. And forgot to put the lid on the blender and it went everywhere and I had a full meltdown. And it just was like the epitome of, this is my new life and I don't have a handle on it and I don't know how I'm going to make this all work.
Yeah, it's, I have way too much pasta in my life, but it's something that I'm allowed to eat, right?
That's right.
And if that's where I'm going to use my, I think it's 3 ounces of cheese I'm allowed a week, which is to me like, that I used to live off of cheese.
Yes, I could eat a whole block of cheese a day.
Oh, so could I. Like easy. So it's I've just kind of learned that, if I want to have a pickle, it's got to be my favorite kind of pickle, and like it's like a $20 jar, and so you take out like half a pickle, so it has to be like that's the half pickle that I will have this week, and the cheese has to be the best cheese because I'm not going to waste it on like a Kraft single. Right.
I agree. Yes. Right. No, completely. So you're on dialysis now. What's next then in that sense?
I mean, I'm on the transplant list. So I do have some friends and family that have gone through testing have been ruled out already. I at some point, I think this is my push to actually tell people what's happening, because this really is the first time that I'm speaking openly about this, about my new diagnosis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because it was a lot to handle, and it came in as I was in the middle of doing a couple of specials out west, and I still wanted to finish a documentary that I was working on, so I was quite frankly like holding on for my life this time around, trying to finish my jobs but also deal with a brand new reality that came to me I say out of nowhere. I mean, I knew for a couple of months. I just kept thinking that if I just drink enough water, everything will get better.
Everything will be fine. I would probably be in denial too, because I think, you know, we've settled in and we know the rules and we know the parameters, and to have it shift again would be quite overwhelming.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm going to continue working on my projects and, you know, doing the best that I can.
Well, and you also give back so much. Like, you are quite involved with organ donation in Ontario and the Kidney Foundation. And probably that's challenging now, but in past years, tell us a little bit about the work you've done with them.
Well, the Kidney Foundation reached out to me when I went public several years ago, and they asked if I would be part of their campaign. Would they have a campaign in March? And it was, you know, making videos and doing all of these things. And so I continued doing that for them. And then I became one of their MCs, and I shared my story quite well. They actually, they awarded me the Public Awareness Award, I think, in 2022, because I just kept on doing this. So anytime the Kidney Foundation reaches out, they need a moderator or anything like that, I'm happy to pitch in. You know, never thinking that I would ever need them again. And then lo and behold, here I am. But yeah, and anytime somebody asks, I think that everybody with, even within Trillium, like the organ donation organization, anytime anybody asks anything about organ donation, they know. Just call Christina. She will volunteer to be a moderator or to speak. I mean, nobody's asking me to plant trees or like walk miles. It's really there, but I'm happy to do it. And I'm happy to continue to advocate for it, because even though I didn't know that I would ever be there again, I think I'm a good example of why we have to continue talking about it. Because just because I got a transplant, just like and I'm sorry to say it, Amy, but in your case, it's a treatment. It's not a cure. It's, you know, hopefully, I really do sincerely hope that you'll never be in my shoes. But it is a reality for many people, right?
It is a real. I mean, I was 25. I've had it for 25 years.
That's and so bad.
It is fantastic. And I'm very grateful to my sister for donating it. But I say to them, like, I kind of try and say, what am I looking for? I'm fearful a little bit about how long it lasts. Because when I was 25, I was like, I need a little more information. How does this work? And what do I expect? And they're like, oh, we got lots of people who've had it for 25 years and they're 85. And I'm like, well, I won't be 85. So I need a little more context on what I'm looking for, or how do I handle this? And it's a lot of unknown, which I find I try not to focus on too much, but it's always there.
Yeah, there's always an uncertainty. I mean, if you're doing everything right, like that's the most important thing.
That's
like,
all you can do.
That's all you can do is control making sure you take your meds every day at 9 and 10 or whatever your time is, and making sure you drink lots of water and staying hydrated and doing all of those things. I mean, and trying to stay healthy.
That's what we can do. And you talked about Trillium and organ donation. I think we should probably talk about that just a little bit for a few minutes, because it's so important about how organ donation works in Ontario, and do people really understand how they can make their wishes known?
You know, it's so easy to do it. And I think people, there's still myths, and it drives me bonkers, because I really do believe that people in Ontario are well-educated enough and that are savvy enough to understand the way that it works. But apparently a lot of people don't. But like, when you register to be an organ donor, all you're saying is, hey, if you can't save me, then please let me help up to, well, more than 8 people, but you could literally save 8 lives. Should heaven forbid somebody get in a car crash and their kidneys, liver, heart, lungs, gallbladder, eyes,
that's like a new one. It's crazy.
And eyes is a new one. Tissue, there's so much that can be done. And it takes literally 90 seconds to register. You just go to beadonor.ca, you put in your health card number, all of that kind of stuff. When you are treated, a physician in an ER does not go, let's not save her, she's got a good kidney, and I know Brenda down the hall needs one. It doesn't work like that.
No,
not
it doesn't.
At all.
Do people think that?
Some people think that. And that, like, oh, if you say you're going to be an organ donor, they're not going to save you. Why wouldn't they save you? Just because if you pass away, the doctor there does not control who gets that lung or heart or tissue. Like, it goes to next on the list, and they don't have access to that. Like, calm down. You're going to end up being a hero.
Right. That's interesting. I didn't realize that, because I've been through a couple of scenarios like that, and it's a completely separate team that's responsible. Even if you've said yes, they still have to talk to the family. So there's steps before that. Doctor that treated you has nothing to do with procuring or deciding.
No, or deciding where that organ's going. Like, right?
They're not in charge of the list or anything. No.
No. So it's such an easy thing to do, because then parts of you live on.
Yes.
You know, my father, when he passed, although he had, you know, bad kidneys and all of those things, I know that it doesn't sound like much, but, you know, because it does take a toll. Once one of your organs goes, it starts to take a toll on everything else.
Yes.
And the doctors always check to make sure, you know, is that lung good? Is this? Mm-hmm. Nobody's putting in a bad liver or anything into somebody else. Like, there's rigorous tests. But I know with my father that he was able to donate tissue and his eyes.
Hmm. That's lovely.
Because those were things that they could do things with. Yes. Right. And so I'm registered as a donor, but, you know, I think they'll realize, oh, these things don't work. We're quick, but maybe there's something in me that can help
someone.
Yes. Because it really takes nothing.
No, it doesn't. Me as well. And I think when you talked about the rigorous criteria, you referenced a little bit about living donor rigorous criteria. That's also very challenging. When you're waiting and you have family members offering, it's not just offering. And I don't even know if blood type's a factor anymore. It was when I was going through it, but
it is
still. Yeah. So blood type, it's not just blood type. The criteria is massive and they can really only test one person at a time. So that can also be a whole nother thing you go through while your kidneys aren't working and while you're not feeling very well.
Well, that's exactly it. I'll give you my brother as an example. We knew he wasn't the right blood type, but sometimes they can make some, like, if our tissues were aligned and things like that, and he doesn't have, you know, he didn't get this Alport syndrome and he was ruled out, but that still took several months.
Yes. That's what I went through.
Right? Yeah. And then on top of that, like I think that what's really good and what's something I really appreciate as a recipient is the time that the system builds into the process. Just because, you know, Brenda could be a perfect match for me, but they're still going to not tell me that. And they're still going to give her, you know, 6 to 8 weeks to really contemplate it.
It's a big decision.
Because they don't want somebody to feel pressure, right? So Brenda could find out that she's perfect and everything's a go and she's healthy enough and we're a match. And she's gone through some mental counseling to make sure and all of these great things. But at the end of the day, they're still going to wait and not schedule anything quick. In fact, that's what happened with Christina and I. She thought that I knew.
Oh, wow.
And I hadn't talked to her in a month. And I had no idea that she had been approved. And all of a sudden, I got an email saying, you know, here's your next appointment for this. Here's this. And, you know, on the 13th, you're having a transplant. Oh. And it was like, what? I found this out in an email. And so I immediately called her and I said, did you know this? She's like, yeah. I was wondering why you weren't calling. And it was like, she thought that they would tell me at the same time, but no, they gave her like, so I found out, you know, a month or 6 weeks later, and she just thought that I was being really weird and not calling her.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So they really do take care of their donors, right? Make sure that they are in a good position.
They do. And I think you mentioned it just quickly that your cousin is, after post-transplant, was healthy and able to live a complete life. My sister is the same. I mean, she jokes sometimes that the follow-up was nothing because she was very healthy and well taken care of. But once she was healthy, and then it was fine, because we forget that sometimes people are born with one kidney and you can live with one kidney really without any adverse effects to your life for the most part.
It's true. She's so healthy. I hope that, you know, when I'm in my mid-50s, that I can be as active as she is, because this woman is like an avid canoer. She, you know, I don't know. She's got two massive dogs that she chases. She's always building things and she's outdoorsy. Oh, she's literally like a Jane of all trades. And I don't have the energy to keep up with her. I don't think anybody, I ever would have, but yeah. It's nice to see, or I'm very thankful to see, that it didn't have a negative impact on her.
Yes, because that is not the idea. It's supposed to help and you're supposed to still be able to live your life at the end of the day. So before we go, let's just talk a little bit about some of the things that you're doing. You referenced these documentaries. When are they out and what can we watch?
So most of them have already been out. They're called Veracity. And so we have, you know, if you Google Veracity prison mums, for example, that's where we spent time with women that are in federal prisons, trying to raise their kids. Some of them alongside them in the prison, some of them, you know, through the bars.
Wow. We'll put all the links in the show notes so everybody can go watch, but I want to hear more.
Oh yeah. I appreciate that.
Yes, absolutely. I love a good documentary personally, so I'm all in.
Well, and everything's focused on Canada stuff, right? So we tracked the source of illegal crime guns. And, you know, we speak with a gun smuggler and the cops that actually track them down. We've done sex trafficking ones where we've staked out hotels and sex trafficking joints and held police to account for, frankly, not knowing when things are happening and not actually doing anything. And you'd be surprised because... I don't know. I told happier stories, but you know, there's sometimes good stories of redemption, right? I just spent a lot of time with a convicted murderer and a convicted violent offender. And, you know, they're both out now, and that's in a film called Debt to Society. And one of them has completely turned his life around, and now he's a cowboy and he's a welder and he's living on a farm and raising animals. And he's really atoning for his previous acts. And, I don't know. Sometimes I think I'm really, honestly, Amy, I'm just so lucky that I get to tell these stories. I really am.
Well, I look forward to watching all of them. And I want to really thank you again for taking the time to tell your story and talk about your recent story, because losing the kidney and having to face the donor that gave it to you is not an easy thing to do in a private room, let alone on a public forum. So I commend your courage for doing that.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, well, it's a privilege for me. I mean, I do some work with the Kidney Foundation and I do come across transplant patients, but I don't think I've ever really had this type of a conversation with a fellow transplant patient, sort of being able to talk about the same things and have the same understandings of the things that you say. So it's been a real privilege for me as well.
Yeah, thank you. Best of luck.
Thank you. And to you too. I will be watching your story with great interest.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Voices of Leadership is part of the Bespoke Productions Hub network of independent podcasters. If you are interested in partnering with us as a sponsor, or if you have a podcast of your own, please visit bespokeproductionshub.com for more information. This episode is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Amy Schluter.